couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Angel Has Fallen, Ready or Not, The Peanut Butter Falcon, and One Child Nation. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and have an interview with the producer of The Peanut Butter Falcon, as well as talking about the home cinema roundup featuring The Hustle. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There is one piece of news that is dominating the entertainment world right now. Apparently, there's trouble in paradise. There's a split. There is a potential divorce separation going on between Sony and Marvel Studios. When Sony was on the edge of the cliff facing bankruptcy back several years ago because of the Sony hack and some low-performing films, they made a deal with Disney to bring Spider-Man into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is, of course, following the very high-profile collapse of the Amazing Spider-Man films that had reduction in box office over the first two, and the inability to launch their own franchise based simply on the Spider-Man character. And so they brought in Tom Holland, and they put him into Captain America Civil War, and he shows up, of course, in the Avengers movies, and then they had these standalone films. Now, the deal was that Disney or Marvel Studios does the Avengers movie. So if it's a movie like Captain America Civil War or Infinity War or Endgame, they can profit off of that. And then Sony would independently produce their own Spider-Man movies, which they did, Spider-Man Homecoming and Spider-Man Far From Home. Now, what's happened over the last couple years is you had Venom come out, and that was kind of a big hit for Sony. And then you also had Spider-Man Far From Home, which just topped $1 billion worldwide. Add to the fact that Sony has some money-making properties now with like Jumanji in their pocket, which they didn't have back when they were struggling and wanting to get involved in Civil War. Now Sony's like, well, but we want to keep this as our own. I think Sony still wants to build its own Spider-Man franchise, and they don't want Marvel Studios meddling with it. And Disney wants to renegotiate the profit split and say, hey, we'll co-finance the movies with you, these standalone, and instead of giving us just 5% of the profit, you know, we'll put 50% of the money up, but we want 50% of the profit back. And Disney's like, no, our movie's made $1 billion. We can now do this ourselves. Here's the thing why it's so stupid. And I know there are people out there who are on both sides. I know that people love to hate on Disney because it's this big corporation that just bought Fox, and they think it's going to have a monopoly on superhero movies. Well, just make better superhero movies in other studios. If you really want to compete with Marvel, make better movies. DC should have been doing this 20 years ago, and they still can't get their crap together. So Sony, some people will defend Sony and say, well, you know, they're just trying to stake their own claim, and they want 90% of the profits, which they deserve. But people are also against Sony because they're like, hey, you're taking Spider-Man out of the MCU. There's a couple things going on. I don't think there's anybody who can deny the fact that without the Marvel Cinematic Universe, without the Avengers films, you wouldn't have had Spider-Man Homecoming or Far From Home, and Far From Home certainly wouldn't have made $1 billion without that Avengers connection. In fact, I challenge anyone who has seen Spider-Man Far From Home to describe the plot of that movie without using terms like Avengers, Tony Stark, Nick Fury, or any sort of connection to the MCU. You can't. It's hardwired into the thing because it's about his relationship with Tony Stark and about him sort of getting the company after that and he's relating to the Avengers, and it's about the blip, about the 5-year difference in coming back to life. It is hardwired into that script. And also the fact that was the first movie to come after Endgame. So of course it's going to do well. It got completely goosed in the box office. There's a reason why Captain Marvel made as much money, because that was also goosed with the box office having to fall right between Infinity War and Endgame. That's just the way the business works. It's the same reason why Iron Man 3 did so well the summer after the Avengers. it did better than Iron Man 1 or 2, and a lot of people will argue that it's not the best Iron Man movie, but it had all that momentum going in. And they're talking about removing Spider-Man completely from that momentum and giving him his own thing. The other thing they don't realize is, while there were fans of Venom, there is no guarantee that more Venom movies are going to do well. If they start spinning it off into Carnage, it still has to be done well. And arguably, Venom was mediocre done, but it still might be entertaining. This could end up being like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles series, where that first one did well when they rebooted a couple years ago, and then the sequel just didn't do well. The same thing with the Lego movie. Lego movie was a big movie. They're going to have a whole franchise, and that whole thing fizzled. There's no guarantee that further Venom movies are going to do well. The problem Sony's facing is they want to have their own franchise. They want to build a Sinister Six thing and the Carnage and Venom, and they want to have Spider-Man. But if they divorce themselves from Marvel Cinematic Universe, there's no going back. They can't come back with the tail between their legs and say, oh, can we do this again in 5 years? Kevin Feige has set this up, and he has plans for this. And if they remove Spider-Man, he's going to have to do a lot of shuffling and changing. And they're not going to be jerked around like that. They're going to say, okay, if you leave now, it's over. We will never have Spider-Man in the Marvel Cinematic Universe again. And that's it. And that's just a foolish endeavor. And I think that it's both sides being greedy, but I also think it's Sony not having all the eggs in the basket. Disney has all the eggs. Unfortunately, they've got all the eggs because they know what to do with the eggs, whereas everybody's been dropping eggs elsewhere and cracking them, and it's ridiculous. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Dolomite Is My Name, which opens later in 2019 on Netflix.
Hey, you know, Auntie, I was thinking about putting out a comedy record.
Comedy? You've been a singer? A shake dancer?
I come up with a new character.
Dolomite Is My Name?
What'd you do to your hair? You look like a pimp.
It's all pretend. I just created a character.
Whatever it takes, I'm ready to do it. I got to be totally outrageous.
It's filthy. You've got a product here that you can't sell or promote.
This is a biopic of Rudy Ray Moore about how he created the character of Dolomite, where he became a showman because he wanted to become famous and sort of created this iconic character in the time of blaxploitation, following up Shaft. You got Eddie Murphy. It's a bit of a diversion from his Eddie Murphy stuff, but it still fits with the type of comedy he would do and the type of attitude he's always had on screen. It looks like this is going to be funny. I don't know if this is going to be an award contender because they have this sort of loose, we're going to release it later in 2019. If they're going to just try, I don't even know what they're going to try. But it's directed by Craig Brewer, who did Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan and Footloose. So he's a good director. I'm curious to see this movie, but I don't know what their plan is with it. And they better get that together because, you know, it's the end of August. You got award season coming soon, or just drop it on the service and have people enjoy it. The next one I want to hit is Underwater, which opens on January 10th.
Listen carefully. You are now 5,000 miles from land. And you're descending 7 miles to the bottom of the ocean. See you all in a month.
Here we go.
We drilled to the bottom of the ocean, and we don't know what came out.
Gotta get to the station.
How will we even get there?
We walk. We're just gonna walk with insufficient oxygen across the bottom of the ocean.
You don't know what's out there.
This is a giant creature at the bottom of the ocean attacking people working in an underwater habitat. We've seen these movies before with stuff like Leviathan and Deep Star 6, and even to an extent The Abyss. There was a whole rash of those back in the late 80s, early 90s. I enjoyed those movies. I love these sort of dive movies. It's a subgenre I kind of get into. And I have to say, it's got Kristen Stewart in it. She's sort of the headliner of this. And at least it looks like she's still trying to go against the type. She looks like she's now trying to say, okay, I got to abandon the Bella image completely and do my own thing. That's the most intriguing thing I think is about this movie, is what Kristen Stewart's going to bring to the table. Oh, and of course, the monsters at the bottom of the ocean. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Angel Has Fallen and One Child Nation. to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews with the one that's probably going to win the weekend, at least for the newcomers. Angel Has Fallen. Secret Service agent Mike Banning is suspected of attempting to assassinate the president, sending him on a run to prove his innocence and save his commander-in-chief.
There's been an assassination attempt on the president.
Mike Banning, you're being charged with the attempted murder of the president of the United States.
The president's top guardian angel has fallen.
Can't you see that I'm being set up?
You have a collect call from
Mike.
We've been getting death threats.
There's somebody else behind us. It wasn't me.
The president's not safe. They're going to try and finish the job. And I'm not going to stop until I prove who did this.
This is the third movie in the... What are we calling it? Are we calling it the Has Fallen series? That sounds like a teen series, but it's not. There was Olympus Has Fallen, and then London Has Fallen. I had a lot of fun on those first two movies. That reminded me so much of a movie like Invasion USA, and I can't remember which one I saw. I saw one of them, and then had to go home and review a Blu-ray of Invasion USA, and I watched it like the night I came home from that screening. And if you don't remember Invasion USA, it was a Chuck Norris movie back from the late 80s where Chuck Norris was the lone wolf trying to stop some Russian invasion where the Russians were getting a beachhead into the U.S. I don't know how they managed to do this. All of these jingoistic button pushy things from the 80s. And it's fun to watch, especially if you don't take it too seriously. I mean, if you're looking at like Invasion USA with Chuck Norris and you really thought that that's what the threat of the Cold War was, you're bonkers. The big difference between this one is while you have a lot of the same players and you got like Morgan Freeman playing the president again, because I think he was a president in London Has Fallen. They turn the script around. So instead of it being one man trying to protect another guy, like personally through the movie, and then they both kind of have to take up arms, what ends up happening is it turns more into something, you know, a little bit more of like a 3 Days of the Condor type movie where, I mean, with a little more action to it and a lot more explosions and more big gunplay and more giant black SUVs driving. But if you remember, like, 3 Days of the Condor was a on the run, chasing a conspiracy, being chased by a conspiracy type movie. And that actually played into a movie like Captain America, The Winter Soldier, which they did tribute to that much better. This one gets a little clunky. It also gets a little hard to follow at times, or not hard to follow. Just hard to swallow, you know, watching this thing going, okay, this is a little silly and this is kind of dumb. It doesn't hold together script wise that the integrity of Olympus Has Fallen and London has fallen a bit. It's still fun to watch Gerard Butler do his thing. I mean, I still think he's a good tough guy action hero. He's as good, I think, as somebody like a Chuck Norris from the 90s or 80s. And I'd like to see more of Gerard Butler do this stuff. But this one felt a little bit substandard to me. It just didn't pack the same punch that the other two movies did. So I'm going to have to say, unfortunately, Angel Has Fallen kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with One Child Nation. This impassioned documentary examines China's infamous one-child policy and the repercussions it had on its citizens.
I was born in China in 1985, a time when China's population crisis was making headlines around the world.
In an effort to protect its people from starvation, China has enacted a policy limiting families to just one child.
I never thought much about what the policy meant for me or anyone until I learned that I was going to be a mom. None of my family questioned the policy or how it was implemented.
Like most Americans, I'm not intimately familiar with the One China policy. I mean, I was aware it existed. Back in the 70s and 80s, I remember it being a thing. They've since changed it to, well, you can maybe have two children because they're losing young people. I mean, every time, if you have a population that each couple has only one child, you will half that generation. The generation just gets smaller and smaller. So it's not a sustaining thing. And they found that after that policy took hold that there were some later blowback to it from a cultural perspective and from a population perspective. But this is about a Chinese-American woman. She was born in China in the 80s, and she has moved, I believe she has moved to the United States, but she has her roots in China. And when she became a parent, she kind of looked at what that policy meant and then looked at it historically. And this is not meant to give a comprehensive view of everything from Chinese officials all the way up to Mao Zedong down to your farmer in the fields. It's basically a snapshot of the region, the area where she grew up. And she interviews family members, her family members, because she actually was in a family that had two kids. She had a brother who was younger than her because they, of course, everyone wanted a son to give. And you see why, and they talk about why they want a son and the cultural impact of that and the cultural way of looking at the son stays around, but the girls go off and join a different family. And yeah, you can sit there and say, well, that's backwards and antiquated and misogynistic, but that's the culture. That's the way it was, especially for the older generation. But it also goes in and it looks at not just the people who were affected by it on which kids they could have and which they couldn't, and some of the horrible things that resulted from them having a girl and the abandonment of some of these children out into the marketplace. But she also interviews some of the officials who are in charge of enforcing this policy. And, you know, one of the things, the sort of a theme that runs through this is the, what could we do? The government was telling us we had to do this and we had to do this, or they'd come burn your house down. And they interview people who did forced sterilizations and were in charge of forced abortions, which were oftentimes late terms. And some of the demons that they're carrying with them and the baggage that they have, it's uncomfortable to watch because you really see how a policy can cause people to do some horrible things. But, you know, as a big dumb American, I was just aware of the policy. I didn't know the internals of it. The other thing that's fascinating is it looks at some of the propaganda that promoted this policy. And I love looking at Asian propaganda in particular, because like communist Chinese propaganda and like North Korean propaganda, there's such a cultural difference between Americans and China and North Korea. And there's such a language difference and even a cultural difference with the type of music that when you get a translation, it's so absurdly clear that it's propaganda. But that's the thing is we're insulated from everything that makes propaganda digestible to a people. But somebody who's steeped in that culture doesn't realize that. And now and you're forced to look at your own stuff and try to discern what's out there in the media and the news and on social media and be able to tell the difference between propaganda and actual news or opinion. So I found that fascinating as well. And also it has this whole thing about the international adoption of Chinese girls, where it turned into a giant human trafficking ring. But it also has this weird moral ambiguity because you're like, well, if they didn't traffic those kids out to international adoption, they would have just died in the streets, quite literally. So it was this weird one hand washing the other, perpetuating everything, but having a moral ambiguity there. So it's a fascinating documentary, and so I'm going to have to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Ready or Not and the Peanut Butter Falcon. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Ready or Not. On her wedding night, a young bride is forced to play a violent game with her new in-laws.
So, at midnight, you have to play a game. It's just something we do when someone new joins the family.
Hide and seek? Are we really going to play that?
The rules are simple. You can hide anywhere. We then try to find you.
So there's no way for me to win, right?
I mean, stay hidden till dawn.
No, thank you.
Good luck.
It's insane.
I had to play along so that I can get you out. They think they have to kill you before sunrise. Something very bad will happen to the family.
This may not appear to be a comedy when you look at the subject matter because it's horror movie-based stuff. It's basically like Hunger Games in a locked mansion. And there have been a series of movies that are either action movies, but more often horror movies that feature a bride. in her wedding dress. I mean, something like Wreck 3. And so there's something where you take that symbol of purity and innocence, a white wedding dress, and you drop it into something horrible like this, that you get that juxtaposition and it makes for great cinema. And this movie is done as partly as a deconstruction of the genre, but also with its tongue firmly in its cheek, which not everybody's going to get. There are going to be some people are going to watch this movie and say, oh my God, it's horrible and it's violent and it's at the level of The Purge, or it's like The Hunt and we should ban it because it's people killing. And look, we can't go overboard on that. There's no political motivations behind this movie. This is taking a horror movie premise and sort of taking it to a ludicrous level. First of all, the film is shot beautifully. It's actually one of the best shot movies I've seen. If you remember the movie last year, The Favorite, which Olivia Colman won the Academy Award for. But in this movie, the shooting within the dark, creepy, wooden, classy looking mansion, there's such contrast and such beauty in there. And then of course you put it up against the horrible things that are happening. With them trying to kill her and her trying to overcome the shock and the grief and the terror at the beginning to then turn the tables and try and go after them. And it's a really neat movie, but also just whipcrack funny. It is very, very funny. Now, you have to have a twisted sense of humor like I do. So if you don't, you might be at a disadvantage. It reminds me of when there was a movie probably about 7 or 8 years ago, You're Next. And it was a deconstruction of the home invasion genre. And I remember the screening that they had in town. It was just a normal person screening. It just people would win their tickets from a radio station or a newspaper. And then they all went to go see the movie. And so it was not like packed with horror fans. It was a bunch of just normal people. And this whole crowd just was in shock and just disgustedness with this movie. I'm sitting there in the front row laughing like a madman at this movie, thinking it's hilarious, and no one else is getting it. And I'm like, doesn't anyone else notice how funny this is? And I talked to other critics and they said, oh, it was terrible and it was nihilistic and it was glorifying violence. And I'm like, no, it's deconstructing the genre. It's looking at home invasion movies and it's breaking them down. That's what this movie reminds me of. The only difference is when I saw this movie, they packed it with horror fans. And so everybody in the room got the jokes because I had since seen like You're Next with an audience of horror fans at a movie marathon. And that thing plays like gangbusters in front of an audience that understands the movie. So that would be a great pairing double feature with this film because it goes crazy and it goes over the top and it gets very gory and it's very bloody. And it also has a real interesting what would you do situation that keeps cropping up in many different aspects throughout the film. So I had a lot of fun watching Ready or Not. It is not for everybody, please. It is not for everybody. And I don't want to talk too much about the specifics of it because I don't want to be spoilery with it. But boy, is this movie a hoot to watch if you're like me and have a sick sense of humor. So I'm going to have to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the next movie, which is The Peanut Butter Falcon. A young man with Down syndrome escapes a state home and goes on the run with a fugitive to find an old professional wrestler and chase his dream.
Come to my wrestling school.
That's what he wants to do with the rest of his life.
Yes, it is.
You let a half-naked boy with Down syndrome who has no idea how to get along in this world just slip out from under your nose.
Are you following me?
Maybe we could be friends and buddies, bro dogs, and chill. Have a good time.
You seen the wrestling schools in Aiden?
Yeah.
One long road leads all the way down. I'll drop you there then.
This is one of those movies that I went and saw completely cold. I didn't go see a trailer. Every now and then I like to do that because I get to see movies generally before they get released. Now, you can avoid trailers and then see a movie before most people see a movie, I like to go in cold sometimes. And it's sometimes jarring and it sometimes doesn't work. But if there's, and obviously you know what an Avengers movie is going to be about superheroes, or a Jurassic Park movie is going to be about dinosaurs. But to know nothing about a movie and not even know if it's a comedy or a drama or what the kind of characters are in it, and I find that fascinating. And I went and saw this movie, and you got to see it unfold as it went. And it grew. I mean, now what's interesting is I saw it in a screening with a bunch of, one of the producers was there, who I interview in the next segment. But one of the producers was there and his whole family was there. And you had people from, because it has a character with Down syndrome, and had like a bunch of people from a Down syndrome organization. So, you know, I had to overcome just the fact of, is there any bias there? But, you know, soon you start watching this movie and it really grows on you, and it's really, really sweet, because it's essentially a story of friendship, and it's not corny or cheesy. And this really could have gone corny or cheesy. I mean, it could have gone TV movie level of schmaltz, or, and I've railed before against like faith-based movies. Because I see a lot of those movies just going right for the corniness and the cheesiness and just slathering it on and not having much subtlety with it. Whereas something like this avoids the corniness and cheese because it's so off kilter and so different. And that's what's kind of fascinating about the movie. And now the other thing that is fascinating about it, and kind of what I think makes it into a significant movie and raises it above what it otherwise would be, is the lead actor, not Shia LaBeouf or Dakota Johnson, but Zach Gottsagen, who plays the character of Zach, who himself, the actor, has Down syndrome. And I remember talking to the producer, and he was like, oh yeah, these other managers and agents and producers kept saying, trying to get this one A-list actor and play the role. And they wanted to cast it. And he referred to it, because we were talking about how the R word has kind of become verboten since Tropic Thunder. And he said, yeah, they were trying to cast people like in a Tropic Thunder way. And they said, no, we got Zach. Zach is a great actor. And he is. And that's what's so fascinating about this movie, is it makes a difference putting an actor with Down syndrome in the movie to play a character with Down syndrome, rather than have somebody use makeup and prosthetics and acting to become that character, because there's an authenticity there. And just the way it was important for a movie like Black Panther to have an anchor black superhero, or why it's important for movies like the Fast and Furious films to have a multicultural cast, because that reflects the world and why it does so well overseas. That's why it's important to have that. And especially if the character is Down syndrome, to cast a capable actor in that, because if you have Down syndrome and you see it, you suddenly get to see yourself as the star of the movie, as opposed to somebody aping your mannerisms and can potentially be even offensive. That's one of the strengths of this movie, is it, because what it also did is it forces them to do what the movie preaches and treat him like a normal guy, not to treat him with kid gloves and not to say, oh, he's not capable. Give him a chance to do it. And the kid does a great, I think the actor's in his 30s, but he does a great job in this movie, and it's sweet and it's got heart, and it comes close to being corny, but it avoids that. It's really a great little movie to watch. So in the next segment, I'm going to be talking with the producer of the movie, but at this point, I'm going to have to say I'm going to give it my rating as a totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be interviewing David Theiss, the producer of Peanut Butter Falcon, talk about the box office, and have the home cinema roundup featuring The Hustle. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up this show with an interview. I don't do a lot of these, but this one dropped into my lap, and I thought it would be really interesting to do. The producer of the Peanut Butter Falcon, who also served as one of the cameramen and like even a stunt guy at a certain point, he wore many hats, David Theiss, who is actually from Cincinnati, so he's from my neck of the woods. I'm from Columbus, and we talked about the production of the film and some of the challenges he faced. One of the things that you hear a lot, there's no original content.
everything sequels, reboots, superhero movies, and the like. For all intents and purposes, this is a completely original movie. How do you convince Hollywood to do something like that, fund it, and release it?
To me, independent films is almost every other film outside of what you just described. Big business has stockholders that they need to report to and show profit. So these types of films are really hard to make. And one of the things that people need to do is get out and see it while it's in the theater, because those numbers are what tell these independent financiers and these people that do finance. We were lucky enough to come across Armory Films, Chris Lamole and Tim, that had done movies like Mudbound and Arctic. And they saw the proof of concept and read the script and thought, there's really something to that. This is a story that is original in the way it's written. It's not original. It's Mark Twain, and they even, you know, say it in there. It's like, hey, you like Mark Twain, Louis L'Amour? You know, these guys are tipping their hat to those guys, and it's a journey film. It's a road pick. And for me, when I read the script, I always wanted to make my Stand By Me. When I watched Stand By Me when I was younger, I was just like, holy cow, that is such a good movie. And to me, this is my Stand By Me. So to make an independent film and find money, you know, a lot of these movies or script will be written and never get shot. And to be opening in 1,000+ theaters goes to say a lot about this film. And now I'm just excited and nervous for it to go wide to see what it's going to do. You know, a lot of people are showing the word of mouth and they want to get the point out, because movies like this aren't really made anymore.
Talk a little bit more about the relationship with Zach, the rest of the cast and the crew. Also, I know I'm not asking you to speak for him, but kind of what's he looking to do more of?
Act. I always said there was a Zach effect. There are people that walk into a room that command a room. You know, a lot of the A-list actors, when they walked into a room, people go, who's that? Even if they don't know who it is. Big business people, CEOs, they walk in and they just have a way that they carry themselves. Zach bounds into a room and is full of love. When he meets you, it's 100% love right out of the gate. And you'll see Shy in some of the interviews talk about how when he first met Zach, his heart was 100% open. And Shy knew that he had to up his game, because Zach's acting is not really acting. He knows his character, he knows what he wants to do, and he does it. So it's exciting for me to watch Zach interact with anybody, because it's so much love right out of the gate. He would end the day every day with giving a talk. You know, Mike, today you were the best director. And Tyler would go, what about me? Well, maybe tomorrow, Tyler. You know, and he would literally go around and make sure that he touched everybody in one way over the course of the filming. And I don't think he thought about it. It's just what he would do. There's so much love exuding from him. And I call it the Zach effect, that every person on this set was affected. That it was 100% family. And when we had a red carpet, so I saw Dakota, I saw John Hawks, I saw Shy. It's like we never left the set. It was big hugs right out of the gate. And, you know, Shy has said in one of the Q&As, he doesn't think he'll ever have a family on set like this one. It was so special doing this film. You know, it affected everyone. It was like going to summer camp and working your butt off and then not wanting to leave and wanting to maintain, you know, that relationship, and knowing that everyone's got to go their separate ways, but knowing that that special moment is ours forever.
Well, the flip side is always there's challenges with any production, especially independent with limited budget and time. I would imagine one of the biggest challenges you had was shooting on water and just outside. I mean, 80-90% of the movie's outside. What were some of the challenges for that?
Every independent film has to overcome pretty much everything along the way. They tell you not to shoot with children, animals, or boats, water, and we did basically all three. So we originally were hoping to get 40, 42 days of shooting. And as we got onto water, every time a person's in the water, there's one person tied to that person on a jet ski or something for safety, you know, per union. So that when we're doing a river crossing, I'm shooting the water stuff. And so I'm in the water with Zach and Shia, and there are three people that you don't see off camera that are all sitting there. Those fees go up as you're adding more people and more boats and more this. So we ended up shooting in 31 days. So budget wise, you got to give and take. So we lost, you know, 9-10 days of filming based on what we were doing, but we were like, okay, this is important. This isn't as important. So knowing what I know now, you think twice about getting another script on water.
One final question for you, and this might be a different answer depending on what hat you're wearing. Are you a good guy? Or are you a bad guy?
I'd have to let Zach answer that, but I'd hope he'd say I was a good guy, because there's so much love around this film that, you know, just to see people at a screening walking out going, you know, they're affected. they're affected the way Zach affected us, the way the movie affected us. And it's so exciting to see people come out making them think, I'd like to think I'm a good guy, but we'll have to ask Zach.
A big thank you to David for taking time to talk to this fat guy here. And if you want to hear the full extended interview, that is available on the Fat Guys at the Movies site. So you can check that out now. But now it's time to talk about the box office on Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Good Boys. What's so funny is Good Boys made over $20 million last week. It was a big surprise. Nobody predicted that except me. I was saying it's going to do well. And Angry Birds movie 2 did not do well, especially compared to Good Boys. Neither did 47 Meters Down Uncaged. Everybody was like, but Good Boys, that doesn't have anybody a star. It just has Seth Rogen as a producer. It doesn't matter whether you have stars. Now, if you're not going to make that $200 million opening weekend, but you can make a $20 million opening weekend easy if it's an entertaining movie, has good buzz, and it's marketed properly. All that needs to happen. You can't market a piece of crap to get to $20 million, and it plays well. So I was not surprised at all to see a $21+ million opening weekend and then everything else sort of puttering along. Now this week, of course, I think Angel Has Fallen is primed to be the top one. And unfortunately, I don't think Ready or Not, especially when you take into account how well it did over the week, because it opened on Wednesday, well, technically Tuesday night. That's not going to do terribly well, which is a shame. But like I said, it's not for everybody. But yeah, look for Angel Has Fallen, and I hope Peanut Butter Falcon gets a little bit of traction, because that should do well. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The one I want to talk about this week is The Hustle, which is out on Blu-ray and DVD this week. Two con women in the French Riviera make a wager on who will be the first to bilk $500,000 from a young yet naive billionaire.
Impressive. I'm a con artist.
Sisters in arms.
I had no idea how small time I was until I met you.
Penny. Why are women better suited to the con than men? Because no man will ever believe a woman is smarter than he is.
I could be the partner you never knew you needed.
Teach me your sugar baby ways.
First lesson, there's nothing more compelling to a man than a vulnerable woman.
This is obviously a remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which itself is a remake. I watched Dirty Rotten Scoundrels when this came out. I didn't get a chance to see this one. I think I just got too busy and I didn't go see the evening show that I would have had to pay for. So I got it on Blu-ray and DVD and I decided to watch it, give it a try. I have to say, I'm surprised at how close, I mean, really close to Dirty Rotten Scoundrels this is. I mean, almost you could do a one-to-one comparison. I think there's some scenes in there that are in the same location. Now, granted, it's 30 years difference between these two movies, but it does play very similar. The only things that really get changed is some modern references and flipping the gender. And that's kind of what the problem is. When they add modern stuff, like there's, instead of running around with a bag of cash, they have it on like a Venmo account. Like, oh, I can send you money through my cell phone, these new trickery devices. That just feels clunky. The other thing is, of course, flipping the genders and making and con women. It's almost like they go out of their way to keep reminding you they're women, and as opposed to just telling a silly little story. Rebel Wilson and Anne Hathaway have a lot of good chemistry together, and they have some funny scenes, but tailoring stuff to their strengths just doesn't make it as good. The whole Ruprecht angle in the original one, where Steve Martin's like, "Man, I go to the bathroom." Yes, you may. And he wets himself there at dinner. They have a scene like that, but it just doesn't quite work with the version that they did for Rebel Wilson. Anytime they made a change, it lessened the movie. And then when they just basically did it as a reshoot, I mean, you could almost edit it into the other movie. I mean, it looks almost virtually the same. So I don't know. I think that that's why it just didn't click. It's an okay movie. And especially if you've never seen Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, you might like it. But yeah, it felt like a pale imitation at times. But I'm going to be generous and say there's a certain entertainment value, and I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about the Playmobil movie, The Fanatic, and After the Wedding. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.